we're in pretty good shape to weather what we think would be a temporary downturn in the market.
Permanent fund managers discuss the financial crisis. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 23rd of September. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, Canadian officials talk up North America's other big gas line proposal.
We have been talking to the state of Alaska about how we can begin to work together to promote Arctic natural gas.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP. Giving back to community is a priority because they live here too. And by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and October, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
The judge presiding over the trial of Senator Ted Stevens narrowed the jury pool today. Jury selection is not yet complete. The court expects it to wrap up tomorrow morning. But today, Judge Emmett Sullivan screened about 45 residents of the District of Columbia to see if they can be fair and impartial when hearing the case, which charges Senator Stevens with 7 felony counts of lying on his financial disclosure statements. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
The potential jurors who appeared in court Tuesday reflect Washington. There were more women than men, and more were African American than white or other races. Among their ranks were federal employees, lawyers, lobbyists, teachers, and blue-collar workers. Judge Sullivan used questionnaires filled out by the jurors on Monday as his guide, following up on ambiguous answers or asking for confirmation of people's beliefs. The jurors' names were withheld, but the screening process revealed snippets of information. The prosecuting attorney and Stevens' lawyers also asked questions of the pool. Of the 45 screened, 16 were dismissed from service by the judge for a variety of reasons, some because of commitments to school or teaching, or past experiences with the legal system, which might make them biased. But others were sent home because of their opinions coming into the trial. One man dismissed is a lobbyist for home-based sales like Avon and is active in the Republican Party, so much so that he called himself a political animal. He'd met Stevens casually at Republican events and told the judge he might have a bias in favor of the senator. He said the allegations against him, quote, seemed to be of a technical nature, more of a regulatory offense than a crime. Another man was dismissed because he's related to someone employed at the law firm defending Stevens. One woman was allowed to leave after sharing that her Christian Science religion teaches her not to pass judgment of others. But some jurors were dismissed for believing Stevens guilty. One said he thinks representatives of the people should be held to a higher standard and said he couldn't get past what he'd read in news accounts. Another man works for a website that blogs about Stevens and said he thinks the senator is guilty, not just of the charges of lying about gifts, but also of doing political favors in exchange for them. The judge made sure he hadn't shared his opinion with other jurors before sending him home. One of the potential jurors who revealed her bias, saying she thought public officials should serve the people and aren't above the law, was kept in the pool because she said she could be fair and open-minded, even though Stevens' lawyers objected to her. Judge Sullivan will continue screening jurors Wednesday morning until he has 36 who are qualified to serve. Then lawyers for both sides will still be able to dismiss some until the final jury is found. The pool of about 30 people who made the cut Tuesday includes some with political ties. One retired university professor said her son is the longtime scheduler for Senator Hillary Clinton. And one man has had dealings with Stevens' office. He's a lobbyist for telecom company Verizon and had a meeting once with one of Stevens' former top aides, Lisa Sutherland. Her name appeared on the possible witness list this week. During the long day of screening jurors, Senator Stevens sat in the courtroom, unsmiling and observant. He left about 15 minutes early. On Tuesday morning, the judge gave Stevens permission to leave the courtroom periodically during the first week for official business. However, Judge Sullivan warned the senator that absences can give the jury a poor impression. If Stevens is absent during the trial, his lawyers wanted to tell the jurors that he was in the Senate dealing with the current financial crisis, but Judge Sullivan said the jury would only be told that there's nothing wrong with Stevens' absence, not what he's doing. Opening statements are expected in the case on Thursday. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 372 points yesterday and another 161 points today as investors reacted to the U.S. government's $700 billion plan to stabilize the nation's troubled financial markets. But at the Alaska Permanent Fund's annual board meeting yesterday in Juneau, trustees and investment experts were bullish on the proposed bailout and what it means for the fund. KTOO's John Ryan reports.
Permanent Fund staff arranged a panel of investment experts to talk about the subprime mortgage crisis, but last week's major meltdown on Wall Street superseded the original topic. The four-person panel was in agreement. Last week's historic government intervention in the financial markets was an unfortunate but necessary action. Rachel Golder of Goldman Sachs says the action staved off a widespread freeze in the flow of capital and a sudden global depression, but she says that doesn't mean there's not more trouble ahead.
We are far from having resolved the problems, even though I think the most important step has been taken. I still think that we have a very significant overhauling and shaking out in the financial services sectors, that there will be more failures of banks, of insurance companies, no more brokers, so we don't really have to worry about those.
Her employer, Goldman Sachs, was transformed on Sunday from one of Wall Street's largest investment banks into a bank holding company subject to much greater federal regulation. The proposed $700 billion federal bailout could mean a budget deficit of more than $1 trillion. Bloomberg News reports that would put the deficit at more than two-thirds the size of the national economy, the highest ratio since 1954. Analysts told the Associated Press such a deficit would weaken the dollar, lift oil prices, and further depress the stock market. But Alaska Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin says no one knows whether the government will lose or make money on its plan to buy up to $700 billion in financial assets.
Those assets may be priced right now at significantly below their actual economic value. So I think the jury's going to stay out, and the market will decide ultimately whether or not this turns out to be something that costs the taxpayer money, is relatively neutral to the taxpayer, or actually provides the taxpayers with ultimate gain in the end.
Critics have questioned whether the bailout plan rewards private interests at the expense of the public interest. And last week, Republican Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky said the Federal Reserve should be given less power, not more, in the wake of the meltdown on its watch.
When I picked up my newspaper yesterday, I thought I woke up in France. But no, it turned out it was socialism here in the United States of America.
It's not socialism, it's the federal government doing their job. It's their mandate to stabilize the financial system.
That's economist Elizabeth O'Connor of Capital Strategy Research in Los Angeles. She told the Permanent Fund trustees that people who don't panic are likely to do well during market turbulence.
Whenever we see panic periods like this, it presents really great opportunities to buy solid companies around the world at great valuations. So if you have a long-term commitment to good fundamental investing, I think that there's a lot of good opportunities individually among companies around the world.
Permanent Fund Board Chair Steve Frank says the fund is well diversified and the board is planning to ride out the current financial chaos.
We're in pretty good shape to weather what we think would be a temporary downturn in the market.
The $35 billion Permanent Fund lost about $800 million on Monday last week, but fund officials say it has made up most of that loss since then. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
A Morgan Stanley financial advisor who does business in Alaska is recommending investors exercise caution as the U.S. financial system undergoes a watershed change. Joel Rosenblatt of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, says the proposed government bailout will have some effect on the general public.
May help some of the people who have mortgages that are in the possibility of default, and it does stabilize the market.
Rosenblatt, who has clients in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Valdez, and Cordova, says he's been fielding a lot of calls from nervous investors. Rosenblatt cautions against making any rash moves away from stocks.
Investors should resist selling out or going to cash. Cash really doesn't make any money, and money markets are not paying even basically the inflation rate.
Rosenblatt says the most important thing remains to be diversified and clear about risk tolerance, especially in light of the modern trading practices attributed with some of the blame for the current problems on Wall Street.
the market has become more speculative with the growth of hedge funds, which are not regulated, allow hedge fund managers to short to bet stocks will go down, maybe to bet more on stocks. There's a strategy called 130-30, where they'll put 130% of their money into stocks they think will go up and 30% betting stocks will go down, so they can make money in both directions. But unbridled shorting caused a lot of havoc in the market and may have been one of the causes of Lehman going out of business.
Highly leveraged trading practices are likely on the way out when Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs relinquished their standing as Wall Street's only remaining independent investment banks yesterday. They agreed to trading restrictions in exchange for government backing of investments. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cleaning up Sitka's beaches.
We found odd things. There was a Hello Kitty drink and fingernail polish.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You can prevent costly damage to the environment with an inspection of heating equipment and fuel oil tanks. Spills can contaminate drinking water and stormwater drains, which can cause health problems for people and animals. Technical assistance is available online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link for assistance to the Home Heating Oil webpage. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Coeur d'Alene Mines is abandoning a compromise plan designed to allow the Kensington Gold Mine to open north of Juneau. In a move that surprised regulators and environmentalists, the Idaho-based company announced today it will no longer seek to dump tailings in paste form near Lynn Canal. That paste tailings plan was crafted with environmental groups after the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found the mine's earlier plan to dump waste in Lower Slate Lake violated the Clean Water Act. Until today, Coeur has been pursuing two strategies at once, developing the paste tailings plan with regulators and fighting the Clean Water Act ruling before the Supreme Court. Coeur spokesman Tony Ebersole says recent comments from the Environmental Protection Agency on the paste tailings plan would delay the mine's opening by months.
We had received word from the Environmental Protection Agency that it wanted Coeur to evaluate yet another new and different alternative.
Not so, says Han Shaw with the EPA in Seattle. She says Coeur seems to have misunderstood the agency's request for more information on the tailings plan.
We were not asking for a new alternative, and we did not raise any new issues on the proposal.
Shaw says the agency simply wanted to fill in some information gaps in the environmental assessment before putting it out for public comment October 9th. She has asked Coeur officials to join a conference call tomorrow to clear up the apparent misunderstanding. But for now, the company is gambling that the Supreme Court will rule in its favor. Tony Ebersole of Coeur expects the court to issue a ruling in the first half of next year. Russell Heath is with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
We are confident the Supreme Court will defend the Clean Water Act. And if that's the case, then it'll be, what, another year before they can get this paste tailings facility repermitted or permitted to start that whole process all over again.
Heath says his group remains committed to working with the mining company to open an environmentally friendly mine. The fourth annual Alaska Oil and Gas Symposium is taking place in Anchorage this week. Attendees are getting updates on the status of Alaska's gas line proposals and the role of resources in Alaska's economy. Canada's Northwest Territories Industry and Energy Minister Bob McLeod will be speaking there tomorrow. McLeod says he expects Canada's Mackenzie Valley gas pipeline to be up and running by 2015. McLeod says his main message tomorrow will be that Alaska and the Northwest Territories have many things in common.
And that we both are blessed with abundant natural resources and with energy. And so I'm talking about the benefits of Arctic natural gas.
And where are you at in the process as far as government permits and agreements with First Nations? Where is the Canadian government at right now with the Mackenzie Line process?
It's been frustrating because of the slowness of the process, but access and benefit agreements are being negotiated with Aboriginal governments. There's seven agreements that had to be negotiated. I think five of the seven have been signed off or close to finalization, and the two outstanding ones are under active negotiation, so we expect that that will be concluded in 2009.
When the Mackenzie Line gets underway, do you think will there still be room for the Alaska Line to go forward? Do you see that it will still be necessary to build that line?
Well, for sure. We feel that both lines will be needed. We have been talking to the state of Alaska about how we can begin to work together to promote Arctic natural gas. And we see the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, the natural gas will allow it to fit into the existing pipeline transmission system, and we see workers that work on the Mackenzie Valley pipeline going on to work on the Alaska pipeline once it's finished, so it would make for a nice transition.
The U.S. Interior Department's decision to list polar bears as threatened not only impacted the United States, Alaska, but also impacted folks in Canada. How has that been for your country?
Well, for our country or for Northwest Territories, where we have a population of polar bears and we do have an active sports hunting industry, it'll effectively kill off the sports hunting of polar bears. And we see that as being misguided because of more concern and impact on polar bears is not sport hunting, it's climate change. And we think action should have been taken to address that rather than just sort of trying to deal with a symptom of the problem.
Are guides feeling the impact now, or has it not yet hit? And what will the Canadian government do to assist them, if anything?
Well, I mean, it had an immediate impact when it was announced there were American hunters out hunting. And so an average polar bear sports hunt averages about $30,000 to $35,000 a hunt. So, it's had immediate impact.
Were you surprised to hear that our governor was running for the White House?
Yes, certainly. I think it came as a surprise. And we think we're starting to see, not only in Canada, but I think in the United States as well, where people are paying more attention to the North. They're discovering the North, its potential, its beauty, and its environment. So they're certainly paying a lot more attention to the North, and I think it'd be beneficial for all of the northern parts of Canada and the United States.
Bob McLeod is the Industry and Energy Minister of Northwest Territories, Canada, based in Yellowknife.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by the new AT&T, your world delivered.
After erupting for more than a month this summer, Ocmok volcano on Umnak Island has calmed down enough for volcanologists to explore the changes within the 5-mile-wide caldera.
What used to be a lush green terrace around the gates is now just this gray-brown wasteland of ash and mud and sand. There's not anything green inside the caldera.
Volcanologist Tina Neal studied the new volcanic formations last week to see how the eruptions changed the area. Some new features include a dozen or more smaller craters filled with water and one new large lake.
And then volcanologically, what's so fascinating is that there's a completely new ash cone, tephra cone, that's been built up on the north side of Cone D. And it's perhaps as high as 800 feet in vertical elevation. So it represents a huge accumulation of debris that erupted out of the ground between July 12th and August 19th.
Though ash covered the island and the local cattle ranch during the 38-day eruption, Neil says the cows seem to be doing fine.
Cows seem happy. They're running around. The tundra is green. Rancher Lonnie thinks that there may not be as much grass feed this winter, so he's worried a little bit about cow mortality, but they don't seem to be showing any ill effects right now, nor do the reindeer who are running around.
The only current danger from the volcano involves the new ash dams that are blocking the creek that flows from the caldera. They could break and cause flooding. Sitka residents came out en masse to participate in International Coastal Cleanup Day Saturday, beachcombing for garbage on a nearby island, in Sitka National Historic Park, and even underwater dumpster diving in one of the local harbors. The event was sponsored locally by the Sitka Conservation Society, the National Park Service, the Sitka Global Warming Group, and the Sitka chapter of Turning the Tides. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
Mount Edgecombe students Abby Fisher and Laura Contrell were among more than 60 volunteers combing the trails of the Sitka National Historical Park Saturday as part of the International Coastal Cleanup.
We found odd things. There was a Hello Kitty drink and fingernail polish. Who brings their blue sparkly fingernail polish to go hiking?
Except for the nail polish, most of what they found was the usual discarded trash you'd expect, like cigarette butts and gum wrappers. But on the other side of the park, fellow Edgecombe students Josh Vo, April Phillip, and Abe Palacios were lugging something much bigger down the trail.
I think you might win the prize for this tire.
I sure hope so.
It took a while to dig it out.
It took us like half an hour to dig it out.
Buried into the rocks. It was along the beach, and there's a little barnacles on it and a lot of mud.
International Coastal Cleanup Day is organized by the Ocean Conservancy. And according to Natalie Sattler, the Community Outreach Coordinator for the Sitka Conservation Society, volunteers in coastal communities all over the globe on this same day, September 20th, are very likely lugging old tires, styrofoam floats, and plastic bottles off their beaches as well.
Basically, an effort to get out there and clean up coasts. And then what we're also asking is participants to mark down on data cards what they're collecting. So whether it's trash from boats or trash from food, toys, anything, just marking it down in like various categories and then tallying it up.
Sattler says the information then goes into an online database run by the Ocean Conservancy.
And then they'll be able to look based on like ocean currents where certain types of trash are showing up. You know, maybe we're going to find a lot of trash from Japan over here.
Residents Phyllis Hackett and Karen Haley cleaning around the Sitka National Historical Park said the most exciting things they found were intentionally planted by the Park Service employees as incentives.
We found two glass bottles from the Nature Conservancy saying we won a prize. Various food wrappers, beverage cans, glass bottles, plastic bottles, cigarette butts, toys, one little tie, a little reflector off of a bicycle. Nothing too exciting. We've been walking on the trails, not the beach.
It's actually and surprisingly it's, clean.
Yeah,
it really is. I was commenting that, you know, our town actually is a pretty clean town.
But that's not entirely the case when you start looking at the bottom of the harbors.
A lot of that looks like it's aluminum cans and an old buoy bag. And,
Henry Larson has been a certified diver since 1979. Today he's handling bags full of garbage that divers Bob Reed, Troy Tideco, and Lynn Wilbur are bringing up from the outside float in Eliason Harbor. Wilbur lives in the harbor, and she says she dives frequently under her boat and recently noticed some old discarded outboards.
There had been some boats from out of town tied up across from me, and it's likely that they dumped their used outboards overboard, so that's also a problem. We have boats coming, transient boats from out of town that offload their stuff. So we're going to try to lift those up today just to get a look at them. And we'll take some photos. We may not be able to get them out, but we'll be able to document where they are.
Within 45 minutes, the three divers have pulled up about 200 pounds of various items from just one float in the harbor.
So we'll try to see what can be reused or recycled. Some of it I would like to put on display just so visitors can see. A lot of the big marine aquariums like Monterey Bay and the Seward Sea Life Center actually have harbor trash displays. And people are very interested in that. They're very proactive about it. It's not a turnoff. And when people see this kind of stuff, they want to know what they can do to help.
Not everything that ends up in the ocean or harbor is intentional.
Is that a full bottle of Smyrna?
Yeah, that's what's in there, too.
That was an accident.
Yeah.
But volunteers who worked on the remote island coastal cleanup say seeing the amount of debris that washes up with the tide is sobering. 22 volunteers also took an Allen Marine boat south of Brent's Beach on Kruzoff Island. That group hauled out 772 pounds of garbage, including 532 pieces of styrofoam, as well as four additional garbage bags full, 72 buoys or floats, chunks of six boats, 221 plastic beverage bottles, three life jackets, and two refrigerators. Lynn Wilbur says maybe we can't get it all cleaned up, but the more people are aware of what's washing up on shores and harbors, maybe the less likely they'll be to throw it out in the first place. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
A Japanese group is visiting the state looking for information and possible descendants of Alaska pioneer Jujiro Wada. The Japanese immigrant traveled to Fairbanks as a cook with city founder E.T. Barnett at the turn of the century. Speaking through tour guide Hitomi Windham of Anchorage, 82-year-old Toshio Wada says he's come to Alaska to find out more about his great-grandfather.
He liked to find out his story regarding this, especially Fairbanks. He stayed with E.T. Barnett and went to the Canada to brought all the gold miner people to the Fairbanks. That started the Fairbanks.
Toshio Wada says Jujiro Wada once had a restaurant on 2nd Avenue in Fairbanks, but also traveled widely as a dog musher. He says his great-grandfather carried mail on what became the Yukon Quest and Iditarod Trails. During his wide-ranging travels, Wada also became a friend and leader among Native people in the Arctic. Wada died in 1937. Windham says Wada's story is well-known in Japan and Dawson City, Canada, but lesser so in Alaska. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell Engineers, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services, on the web at dowell.com. And by
Tech Cominco and the Red Dog Mine, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes.
Lack of maintenance is the primary reason heating oil tanks contaminate drinking water, sewers, and stormwater drains. Homeowners are liable under state law for the cleanup of spills from home heating oil tanks on their property. So prevent spills by arranging an inspection of tanks and heating equipment before and during the heating season. Information online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.